This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Postcolonial feminist scholarship on the formation of gender relations primarily uses the analytical colonizer and colonized dyad. In her new monograph, Gender Politics at Home and Abroad, Professor Hera Che makes an important intervention by examining colonial Korea to propose a new framework that accounts for transnational encounters between national reformists, missionaries, and colonial authorities. Drawing from both major and minor archives in various geographic sites such as Korea, Japan, the US, Sweden, and Denmark, Professor Che locates the voices of the educated Korean women whose reform rhetoric and activities reflect transnational encounters. Postcolonial studies have shown us how archives are contentious political site with prominent feminist scholars such as Antoinette Barton, pointing out the need to understand the interdependence between discursive visibility of minoritized people and their experiences. Through her research, Professor Che is able to show how educated women, despite their status as an elite minority, points to the larger structure of patriarchy and how it is constantly contested and reshaped by forces such as the state, ideologies of Western domesticity, and religion. I am very excited to have Professor Hera Che here today at the New Books Network in Gender Studies to talk about her new book, Gender Politics at Home and Abroad, Protestant Modernity in Colonial Era Korea. Hera, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very excited to have this opportunity to discuss my book.
Yeah, I am also personally very excited to discuss your book as well. And yeah, I can't wait to dive in. So to start off, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write Gender Politics at Home and Abroad?
Okay, thank you for the question. For listeners who may not be familiar with my work, let me just briefly introduce myself. I'm professor of Korean gender history and culture at the University of Iowa. I hold a Stanley Family and Korea Foundation chair in Korean studies and also serve as a founding director of the Korean Studies Research Network. I think my research agenda has been very interdisciplinary in orientation, transnational in scope, and also intersectional in analysis. I have been particularly interested in gender and empire, modernity and colonialism, nationalism, secularism, and most recently, feminist food studies in relation to ecological crisis we have. And so focusing on the main topic for today, this new book, Gender Politics at Home and Abroad, is in some sense a sequel to an earlier book publication entitled Gender and Mission Encounters in Korea, New Women, Old Ways, which was published in 2009 by the University of California Press. So in that 2009 book, I challenge and complicate Korean historiography that often hailed American mission women as pioneers of Korean modern womanhood. I ask, what constitutes the modern? And how American women missionaries understood modernity. But most importantly, how their understanding of modernity intersected with Korean nationalism, Japanese colonialism, Western modernity, and Korean gender ideology and practice. So if the 2009 book largely focuses on American women missionaries and their discourse and activities in Korea, especially from the late 19th century to 1910, the latest book, Gender Politics at Home and Abroad, centers on Korean women who had a wide range of interactions with the missionaries as students in mission schools or co-workers and colleagues in Christian organizations such as the YWCA. Those Korean women became the first generation of educated women in Korean history, and they are significantly shaped the modern feminist movement in the first half of the 20th century. So in this book, I was particularly interested in bringing out the voices and experiences of Korean women, especially those who have not been well-known or well-understood in Korean historiography.
Thank you so much for the really beautiful introduction. I have actually read Gender and Mission Encounters, and in many ways, I thought that this new book was a really amazing sequel that I think really deepened my understanding about the genealogy of modern feminist movement. And because my research also is concerning domestic servitude in colonial and post-colonial Korea, and I started to focus actually more on the YWCA because they they established leadership in reforming households as a site of labor, but also labor discipline. So your work was just so incredibly helpful for me to, think also about the genealogy of what I am studying. I'm really, really excited to further chat about, this particular monograph. So you mentioned that, you're very interdisciplinary and transnational in your approach. And I was, really struck by your methodological reflection in the beginning when you talked about how you're planning on analyzing, and bringing out educated women's voices in colonial Korea. And you make a distinction between transnational versus global history and, explain why you decided on this particular methodology, as well as why you decided to go transnational. Can you tell the audience a little bit more about the significance of your methodological contribution and why you decided to choose transnational history as a method or perspective?
Okay, great. I think I would say there were two related reasons why I thought transnational perspective was particularly central in my research. One is a Korea-specific reason, and the other comes from broader context of global feminisms. First, in Korean historiography, it has long been dominated by a framework that privileged the binary understanding of nationalism and colonialism. It was only from 1990s that framework began to be seriously scrutinized, and the notion of colonial modernity became a powerful analytic tool for reassessing the modern experiences of the colonized. I was motivated to write this book because I wanted to shed a new light on colonial modernity in Korea by taking a transnational perspective, going beyond the nexus of metropole and colony. So I focus on the flow of ideas, images, people, and material cultures across national boundaries. And of course, I do recognize the immense power that colonial governance had in shaping social structures, material cultures, and everyday life in colonial Korea. But one of the key arguments I make in this, in my book, is that a deeper understanding of gender and colonial history is possible only when we articulate divergent sources of influence to shape modern gender relations and the fabric of modern life. So to put it very simply, the claim of hegemony, especially cultural hegemony of Japanese colonial powers, was constantly challenged by Euro-American cultural and material influences during the time.
Yeah.
And then in the context of global feminism, this is another kind of a reason why I took, I really embraced this transnational approach, is that as many feminist historians demonstrate in their work, feminism has a very long transnational history. In a sense, feminist history is a transnational in terms of scope and approach. So that requires us to ask, what were the sources of feminist dreams, ideals, goals, strategies, tactics, or activisms? I claim that they were often found in the transnational community. Women look beyond the domestic boundaries. Korean women also were inspired by models and examples from overseas that were circulated through print and visual materials. In some cases, those Korean women encountered these things directly through travel overseas or studying overseas. And also I should mention that it is very important to say their reliance on Western models, so-called Western models, was severely criticized. But as I demonstrate in the book, those Korean women elite did not adopt Western ideas and practices uncritically. Rather, they were very actively reinterpreting foreign models, rejecting certain aspects of Western models, appropriating other features, and still adjusting, you know, other stuff according to their understanding of the locality. Yeah,
that was one of the most striking things that I found in your book, how you add all these nuances in terms of, you know, this is like not a simple appropriation, but there are various competing forces that also shaped, you know, how these women adopted. And I also found that, you know, how the women and especially the missionaries talked a lot about how they have to be specific to the local context in order to address this fear about modernization, quote unquote, that intellectuals had about, you know, these like encounters that they were having with transnational forces, which I found really interesting. And when you talked about how, you know, you're also, you know, speaking with, you know, global feminist movement and scholarship that preceded them, I was also, you know, struck by, you know, your discussion of the archives and, you know, engagement with post-colonial feminist scholarship. Can you tell us more about how you're contributing to this ongoing scholarship about the politics of archives?
Yeah, thanks so much. This is a really important question. In fact, it has been a perennial challenge in feminist scholarship. We often face a paucity or complete absence of archival sources to provide us with a better understanding of gender history. So what is preserved in archives, what is not there, what has been utilized in writing history, and what has not been utilized. So all of these questions inform us about the politics of archives and historiography. So under these circumstances, feminist scholars, historians, have been proposing alternative ways to excavate hidden histories, unknown histories, to give new value, and also they try to give a new value and meaning to unconventional resources that could help us make sense of the past. So we utilize all possible forms of documents, including cloths, pamphlets, songs, films, photographs, and creative writings and poems, you name all those things. I use the photographs to a significant extent, but in particular, I just wanted to mention that in my research for this particular book, I used a lot of university archive materials that have not been utilized or routinely tapped to bring out unknown stories. I look at grade books, if available, campus newspapers, dormitory records, catalogs, and etc. So for me, it was really like a treasure hunt, searching for any trace of Korean women who crossed domestic and international borders. It was an exhilarating process of discovery, bringing to light what has not been understood or what has been kind of forgotten. At the same time, it was also a very disappointing time because some of the travels to various archival resources frequently yielded little or nothing about these women. Still, for me, it was very important to be there on the site to realize nothing is left. Of course, it might be my own limitation in searching and exploring diverse resources in various countries. But still, I think it was also kind of telling much about the politics of archives and what we should continue to really make an effort in excavating those unknown histories. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that also reminds me how, you know, Antoinette Barton, that, you know, you cite in your book, also kind of talk about how, you know, even when there is absence, it also still speaks in a way volumes about the experiences of the women, how like the post-colonial feminists in a way speak about the significance of absence, and how absence doesn't just mean that, you know, they weren't there, but then rather how we can critically read the archives, you know, not just for, you know, like what is there, but also for like, you know, what is not there, to think about like the politics of visibility. So I think like what you're saying is also reminding me about how, yeah, like in your book, you know, like there is like both like absence and presence, and, you know, they in a way still like construct the story, I think. Yeah, yeah, which I think is really wonderful. Yeah. Well, yeah, thank you so much for, talking about politics of archives and how your work is, you know, like really contributing to bringing to light, you know, all these stories. And, you know, especially I think university archives I found really interesting, that I can't wait to talk about later when we, you know, talk about the genealogy of home economics as a discipline. Before we start, you know, discussing the content, I kind of wanted to go over the main, you know, analytical framework that you use, which is protestant modernity. And I was wondering whether you could maybe help, you know, explain the concept for the audience, and also why, you know, like religion is so significant when we think about genealogy of gender relations in colonial Korea.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You know, modernity used to be understood as a historical path away from religion, yet religions have been really crucial in shaping modernity. And the boundary between the sacred and the secular was never straightforward. It has been actually rather blurred and co-constitutive. Look at the 21st century. Religion is a very powerful player in shaping individual, national, and global politics. So when I analyzed missionary discourse, I saw these very blurred and co-constitutive ideas between religion and secularity. So I want to challenge the conventional understanding of modernity and secularization. So in this book, I use the concept of Protestant modernity as a more or less a heuristic device to unpack the complex dynamics found in the formation of modern gender relations fostered by global Christian network within the very specific historical context of colonial Korea. Centering on this concept of Protestant modernity, I foreground the thesis that Protestant Christianity, introduced to Korea in the late 19th century, was crucial in shaping modern gender relations, along with other important factors such as nationalism and colonial influences. I define Protestant modernity as a composite of religious morality, historical outlook, and material practices that could mean different things to different historical subjects. For example, from the perspective of Euro-American evangelical groups, Protestant Christianity is some sort of ideology that advocates the linear movement in history toward modernity in material and technological aspects. But that also places a moral and spiritual role of Christianity at the core of that enterprise. However, in comparison, for a newly converted Koreans, the centrality of religious spirituality may have sometimes been secondary to the material progress and mundane advantages that were afforded to those who affiliate themselves with Christianity. So the ways in which missionaries were perceived by Koreans manifest how secular advancement in educational or medical or material world was a crucial part of introducing the new religion. In many cases, Christian affiliation tend to provide many opportunities for education, employment, leadership, or even lifestyle. So it is in this coalescing dynamic between the sacred and the secular, and between discourse and experience, that the concept of Protestant modernity can be fruitfully understood. And I would add, this notion of Protestant modernity is particularly helpful in understanding the history of modern womanhood in Korea, because for Korean girls and women, their experience of the modern was significantly shaped by Protestant Christianity. The vast majority of educated women and early feminists were educated at mission schools and had working relationship with the missionaries or Christian groups in one way or another. As one of the Korean intellectuals said in 1930, Korean woman's world is predominantly ruled by Christian women. So to that extent, educated Korean women and elite women's affiliation with Christianity was actually quite significant. So even those who had a very critical opinion about missionaries because of missionaries' racism and missionaries' kind of hegemonic patriarchal attitude, even they acknowledged the value of the opportunities provided by missionaries in terms of formal education and career paths, especially for women. Yeah.
Yeah, I really appreciate how you really blur the boundaries of secular and, religious, and how, for a lot of these, educated Korean women, the material benefits and, in a way, this, commonly, associated ideas of a modernization that is, more associated with a secular regime, was actually very much tied together, that shaped their upbringing and education, which I thought was a very important contribution. And what you were saying about this, the blurring boundaries and the complex role of a Christian missionary women, and how the Korean women also in a way reappropriated and negotiated some of these material benefits and ideological contributions that they gave, is bringing me to the first chapter where you talk about the genealogy of Hyunmo Yangcho ideology. And I was especially struck by the sentence where you said the category of women, quote, actually emerged or became only legible through, these missionary discourses and, the confluence of, the Confucian ideologies, colonial ideologies, as well as the missionary outlook on domesticity. And I was wondering whether you could tell us more about you know, what this ideology is, 현모양처, and how this complicates a more simplistic view that, you know, patriarchy is patriarchy that comes from the traditional, that is, you know, set aside from modernizing forces. By illustrating how, you know, all of these transnational encounters are, you know, in a way complicit in reshaping the meaning of patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'm always excited to talk about 현모양처, wise mother, good wife. So I'd like to probably mention like three aspects. First, I consider wise mother, good wife, 현모양처, as the most powerful gender ideology of the 20th century in Korea and possibly in East Asia. It has been so pervasive, and it is also constantly evolving. I want to show that this very conservative gender ideology is not uniquely Korean or Asian. Rather, it should be understood as a result of the complex transnational interactions among various intellectual, political, and cultural mandates. More specifically, in 현모양처, we find Confucian-prescribed gender ethics from the Joseon Dynasty, the Korean nationalist view of ideal womanhood, Japanese colonial policies that were implemented with the aim of producing royal subjects to the emperor, and Protestant Christian gender ideology brought by missionaries that emphasize domesticity, piety, and obedience. And I think there is a kind of an imagination that Western women are all progressive, liberal, and advanced, but actually Victorian womanhood, American missionaries brought to Korea, were actually quite conservative, but also pretty much in line with the Confucian prescribed gender norms and practices as well. Although I don't want to generalize Confucian gender ideology because it's also very, very complex and it's not entirely oppressive either. And second, my research project always engaged in a broader feminist inquiry, that is, how patriarchal norms and practices were challenged, adjusted, modernized, and even reinforced within the particular historical and social-political context. So the genealogy of 현모양처 sharply shows us how patriarchy persists and reinvents itself, adjusting to the new demands and circumstances. In the age of neoliberalism, a 21st century version of 현모양처 has emerged. In this new version, the core value of the conservative gender ideology is not changing, but it's the images, discourses, and certain manifestations constantly change to accommodate new circumstances. And as you probably know, in the age of so-called post-feminism, some may think feminism is a thing of the past. However, global gender history is full of backlash against any progress that has been made in gender politics. Look, you know, what is happening now? The 1973 Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade is likely to be overturned soon. Unfortunately, history sometimes goes backward, and you know, we have a long way to go. And lastly, I just wanted to also mention that despite the power of male dominant structures, in this chapter, I wanted to bring out how women navigated those oppressive systems and how they resisted or sometimes appropriated the existing system to carve out their own space for empowerment and liberation. And I think that the gender ideology of a wise mother, good wife demonstrates the persistence of patriarchy and at the same time, women's own agency in undermining the very patriarchal structure as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thank you so much for, you know, talking about Roe versus Wade, because I think that had been a shock for many of us, and also a reminder that we really shouldn't take our rights for granted. I think that so I think that was really salient, and especially how you connected to like history and a danger of seeing history as like a linearly, you know, progressive line or narrative, you know, that often, you know, occludes how similar types of violence and exploitation and power dynamic is being perpetrated. And I think what I really especially appreciated about, you know, what you were saying about these like transnational encounters and how, you know, these like Western missionary women were actually quite conservative and really upheld, you know, domesticity ideals, was also kind of the insight that it was also showing about gender as, you know, not just about in a way like being a woman and like being oppressed, but rather like the system of oppression, you know, that is about subordination that is also determined by, you know, the status of like the nation, as well as obviously like the power of colonization, and also how the discourse of modernity is used as a disciplining power in some ways, and how, you know, Korean women though, like, you know, also had the power to negotiate it, so that really like complicating our idea about power through this discussion about Hyung Moyang. So I think is was really meaningful. I think especially for, you know, Korean audience out there, I think they probably know how, yeah, like Hyung Moyang so is still really dominant. And I think even for people who kind of like grew up in America, like I think there is still this dominant ideal of, you know, like pleasing, you know, like your elders, you know, like being a loyal, like faithful, you know, like daughter, and then later on wife. So yeah, I really thought that this was a very like relevant section that really historicized this like very dominant ideology.
You summarized it beautifully and perfectly well.
Thank you. Yeah. I was very struck by this. So yeah, thank you. Yeah. So this genealogy about, you know, the making of, in a way, woman as a category in Korea, then you turn your attention to the households. And again, I also found this extremely relevant, you know, because my research is also about, you know, development of households, you know, as like a with like a modernizing forces. And I was hoping that you could tell us more about how, you know, home was like constructively, you know, like ideologically constructed, and also the influence of home economics as a discipline in colonial Korea.
Yeah, thank you. My research has always emphasized the dynamic interplay between discourse and experience, between ideology and material cultures, and also between the local and the global. So I thought this idea, the idea and experience of a house and home, is just a wonderful example to illustrate this approach. It also demonstrates how modernity was imagined and practiced in the most intimate and private domains, the domestic, while they were still closely tied to imperial and capitalist expansion. And in that book, I also highlight home economics as a discipline to demonstrate the dynamic trans-Pacific flow of ideas, people, and materials. Just like the gender ideology of Hyun Moyang-chul, wise mother, good wife, the ways in which home economics as a discipline was developed by various agents shows the very tensions between compliance and resistance. It shows how conservative gender ideology is reinforced by assigning women to the domestic. But at the same time, the very same ideology enabled women to create new openings and new careers for themselves in the public domain and ultimately on a global scale, under the banner of a scientific home or scientific modern homemaking. So in understanding this transnational and imperial nature of the development of home economics as a discipline, it is important to note that American home economists held authoritative power as teachers. However, I want to emphasize that Korean home economists were not passive recipients of Western theories and practices. they were keenly aware of the local conditions, especially in material conditions. And they realized they really need to adapt Western theory and practice to those local circumstances. And during my research trips, I read Korean students' term papers and MA thesis in home economics, especially at Oregon Agricultural College, which is now Oregon State University. Korean women who went there in the 1920s and 30s. It was really fun, and I could actually see their grade books. I was surprised those grade books were available to me as well, but the archivist was so generous in sharing virtually everything in the archives. But while rummaging through their papers and reading through those materials, it was very clear that those Korean home economists made a very concerted efforts, not only to indigenize Western knowledge, but also to reinterpret traditional values and everyday practices to modernize them. In fact, you know, their exposure to Western modernity made them even more aware of their local tradition, local situations more sharply. And I think they were kind of open to that sort of some new and old ideas and practices in envisioning the future with their own expertise in home economics.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. Wow. This was like such an interesting chapter, especially because in some ways I found like home economics is so important in Korea. It's like a very important discipline in Korea, I feel, while in America, like I don't see home economics as much. I mean, this could just be like my exposure thing, but which also just makes me think about like how the status of the discipline is probably also in a way shaped by the relative positionality of the nation. And the grade part is so interesting because I do wonder like how they were graded, you know, like how these like instructors were grading the ideologies or like the visions of modern home that was expressed by these Korean educated women. So it's really interesting. Did most of them get good grades or were there some like not?
Because they were non-native speakers of English, and so their papers, you know, kind of showed that, and some American faculty members tried to correct their English. But these Korean women, as well as other foreign or international students abroad to this kind of program what was going on in their own countries. So in some sense, American home economics as a field was kind of some headquarter in collecting this global home economics or global home practices. And so this is another kind of element of Western hegemony in producing and circulating knowledge. And they brought international students with some scholarship, and these international students provided local information from their country to enrich the practice of homemaking throughout the world. So there is a lot of some kind of a politics going on in terms of knowledge production and distribution. and also the training international folks is a way to continue to maintain Western hegemony in shaping home economics as well as other disciplines, but home economics in this case as well. So we need to be mindful of that aspect. But at the same time, I mean, I have to say, while reading through those materials and a lot of photographs, there are some genuine bonding and solidarity between teacher and international students there. And their bonding and solidarity continue even after they left the school. Eva Milam, for example, who was a dean of home economics at Oregon Agricultural College, was actually almost like the main person in constructing home economics in East Asia. And so she was invited in post-colonial Korea as a consultant in shaping post-colonial Korea's home economics, and et cetera. And of course, she had disciples who really ruined the field of home economics in Korea from the 1930s and ongoing, even now.
Yeah. Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah, and then to think about that, you know, there are like continuing influences in our thoughts and, you know, like just the knowledge production aspect is really fascinating. And this is actually really reminding me about your final chapter on rural modernity, where you really expand the framework of colonial modernity that really just emphasize on the urban areas in the past. Because yeah, I remember how, you know, you were talking about the importance of this like networks that were, you know, forged between teachers, students, like the deans, that were quite transnational in women and educated Korean women implementing these like kind of like spiritual enlightenment programs for rural residents in colonial Korea, and like kind of reimagining rural areas as like a site of development and like modernization in many ways. So I was wondering whether you could tell us more about how you kind of like came to focus on the rural areas, like whether it was any archival materials that kind of like led you there, how, you know, like you're expanding, you know, the colonial modernity framework by focusing on the rural areas in your final chapter.
Yeah. You know, I think, modernity was often associated with the urban elite and middle class. But the reality of colonial Korea was that it was a predominantly agrarian society. So given that reality, intellectuals and reformers and revolutionaries, they were almost like a force to pay attention to the rural population and community. But as I demonstrate in chapter 4, even those rural communities and campaigns for rural revitalization were deeply connected with the global through religious organizations, ideological institutions, as well as personal network between teachers and students, and etc. And these rural revitalization projects took place from the late 1920s to the mid-1930s. And this was a period of worsening economic conditions in rural Korea. Under these circumstances, women intellectuals and like other male reformers as well, engaged in rural revitalization campaigns, and they drew lots of inspiration and models from their transnational experiences. In particular, interestingly, Danish rural programs were a source of inspiration for Korean reformers. It's not just for Koreans. Actually, Danish rural programs were inspirational to so many people, including Americans as well at the time. And so this chapter offers a very detailed history of the role that women reformers played in the rural revitalization movement. Because in many ways, new woman or educated woman in colonial Korea was always almost exclusively associated with the urban elite. So I just wanted to highlight their involvement in rural project was a significant part of early feminist movement in Korea. And at the core of their efforts was, in the case of women rural reformers, at the core of their efforts was this interdenominational global Christian network that brought people together, people, resources, money, and information. But also this was a way to link urban elite women with a rural populace. So in this chapter four, I argue that women reformers were pursuing an alternative modernity that was inspired by their transnational experience in Europe and the US, but reworked for the local conditions in Korea. What their reform efforts show was that their primary directive was enlightenment, kaehwa or kaehyok, as a pathway to improving farmers' daily lives, actual, daily lives. And with the most, with the vast majority of a rural population at the time mired in illiteracy, deprivation, and poverty, those Korean elite women believed that the rural work in Korea at this particular moment should prioritize a very practical enlightenment project rather than emphasize ideology or resort to lofty abstract ideals. Accordingly, their rural programs focus on basic literacy and numeracy training and practical knowledge about nutrition and disease prevention. So improving domestic family life was very important as part of this rural enlightenment movement. And that sort of some movement also contribute to empowering rural women as they gained more knowledge about nutrition, hygiene, family budgeting, and child rearing. And also remember at the time, many babies and children died at a very early age because of a lack of nutrition, but also lack of medical service available to the vast majority of rural population at the time. Another element is these reformers also emphasize economic independence for women. And this is another key lesson as a rural work encourages women to take side jobs to help with the family finances. So through these programs, leaders of the rural work stressed the indispensable role women play in nourishing the family, enriching the family coffers, and contributing to a healthier, more stable community. But also in a broader context, women's participation in and contribution to the development of a rural community was seen as one of the linchpins in restoring Korea. So here, so like the way I also analyze in the discussion of house and home, and I think this home, house, and domesticity had been perennially undervalued, but these reform efforts also show this domesticity or domestic arena is actually central. So they put the domesticity at the center of movement, social movement, women's movement, and even national movement. So that is a kind of an important aspect. Were they successful? It depends on how we measure success. But what is clear to me is that the rural reform movements were still an important part of early feminist movement, although they were crushed by the Japanese colonial power, especially after the Asia-Pacific War. And there were a few prominent but not so well-known women reformers at the time in rural communities. So I just wanted to highlight their lives and their contributions to women's history here.
I found that this chapter was also very striking for me as well, because when I was doing archival research with YWCA's documents regarding professionalization of domestic workers in post-colonial Korea, they talk a lot about nutrition, how to properly nourish the babies and the moms, and also budgeting and obviously sanitation. So in a way, the focus on the daily life and this tie between a more modernized practice as well as in a way a spiritual reform, because they talk a lot about also how the workers need to have an understanding of their place in the world and how that also translates to these practices. I found your central argument here about how domestic arena became a central movement to be really relevant also in terms of looking at the continuity between colonial and post-colonial movements and as well as the rural and urban areas. And I also found it really interesting too how economy is also actually when we look at the older philosophical documents is actually primarily about the household, how all these philosophers talk about men's primary duty actually is to manage the households first, and how economy actually as a word that started from in a way this management of the household that became a measure for the nation and the state. So I found this insight that really centers the household to look at the larger structure of economy and these networks to be very, very insightful. So thank you so much for going through that for us. And I wanted to, before I close with the last question, I did also wanted to talk about the third chapter. Because throughout this talk and also in the book, one of your primary points in a way is showing this dialectic of agency, reception, this kind of a flow and a travel of ideas that you can really see when we look at educated women. So I wanted to ask you, can you tell us more about how you analyze these travel writing to show, educated women's dialectical awakening?
Yeah, this chapter 3, it gave me perfect justification to travel globally. thanks to some of the really generous grants, I was able to travel really widely within the US, Australia. At the time, I was actually in Australia teaching at Australian National University. I also traveled to Europe, including Sweden, Denmark, Germany, and France, as well as in China, Japan, Korea, in search of any traces of Korean women who travel to those countries, mainly to study. And for Korean women who had been bound by the gender ethics of the inside-outside rule, 내외법 in Korean, and confined to the domestic arena, it was absolutely revolutionary act to transcend the traditional bounds of a family and nation to pursue education or simply to travel to experience the world. So in chapter 3, I examine how such a travel was possible to begin with and what it entailed. And I demonstrate the crucial role of the global missionary network, which served as a channel that young women could use to experience the world beyond the metropole and the colony. I should mention that the majority of Korean women who studied overseas went to Japan. This is also true for Korean men as well. But even in Japan, most of Korean women attended mission-run schools, because there were some very close connections among missionaries and as a teachers and doctors. So they really exchanged their students, they exchanged information, they created this very well-developed network among themselves. So even in Japan, Korean women study at Christian-run schools. And so tracing the travels of these women through Asia, North America, Europe, and Australia, this chapter discusses how their international experience also vaulted them into a new sense of selfhood, racial and national identity, and created the context for the growth of women's movement. Because they were widely or amply exposed to some of the women's movement in those countries at the time. In particular, I just argue in this chapter that their direct exposure to Western and Japanese modernity further sharpened their sense of locality, which in turn shaped their vision for social reform in Korea. And again, educated women have often been criticized, especially by male intellectuals, that these women became so-called Westernized or even Americanized. And I think my research tried to challenge that notion that, certainly these women got influenced by Western theories and practices, but they were never passive recipients of those foreign knowledge. They were very active interpreter of anything they learn and exposed to. So that was kind of an important point. And this direct exposure also revealed to these Korean women that American women, for example, were not necessarily liberated. They have their own struggles. So to me, this type of some direct exposure was a very important complement to how women, Western and Korean women, were portrayed and represented in popular discourse. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this, because I was often, whenever I read any literature on new women, I was really struck by how, male intellectuals always kind of talk about their shallowness, how they're kind of like captivated by this like shiny things of like Westernization, and in a way, like really just talk about them as like just like a passive recipient. So I was really grateful about your contribution and how, you have like all of these like rich, like archival, traces and like evidences that, they were really thinking seriously about their role, about, in a way being like a mediator of these, in a way opportunities and the encounters, and how they were thinking about like the local context and, where they, their own positionality in this process. Yeah. So it was really, really fascinating. Yeah, I've taken up a lot of your time, so I wanted to conclude with the traditional final question for the New Books Network, which is, what is the next project you're working on?
Oh, yeah, thank you. As I was finishing up this book manuscript, we started to explore new projects. They would build on what I've done, but also I want something that would expand and challenge the intellectual orbit I'm familiar with. So in that process, I also should say that I was influenced by various initiatives that focus on public scholarship and humanities for the public good. And I have recently launched a new book project that engages in feminist food studies. Food links us to literally everything from microorganisms to national politics, the global political economy, and the environment. So in this book, I focus on food and gender in global Korea. What I mean by global Korea is a Korea whose history and culture has been shaped by the global flow of ideas, people, capital, and materials. In particular, I plan to focus more on the trans-Pacific foodways, given the very close ties that have been forged between Korea and the United States through religious, political, economic, and cultural interactions, either by force or sometimes through volition since the late 19th century. And in analyzing food in global Korea, I want to take gender and domesticity as the main category of analysis. I joined this recent famous scholarship that takes food and domesticity as a very expedient side of inquiry, not only to challenge the presumed inferior status of the domestic vis-a-vis the public, but to envision new life politics in the current age of excess inequality and ecological crisis. And in thinking of food and gender politics, I approach politics beyond the formal domains of law, governance, and party politics. I take ordinary everyday practices such as eating and cooking seriously as a very contested site in which complex gender, national and national, global, and environmental politics unfold. So I've been really enjoying doing this research, and who knows how long it takes to finish this book. But I feel very fortunate to have found this topic, and it just leads to so many different directions and inquiry paths I could engage. Especially in relation to the spirit of a public scholarship.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds really exciting. I mean, I personally love food and also understand, you know, the politics of food as well. And as someone who is also studying, you know, domesticity and like gender, yeah, this is like really, really interesting. And especially about what you said about looking at this at, you know, as an important side of inquiry to really reimagine new politics, especially in the times of precarity as the COVID pandemic has revealed to us. And I actually for my class read the anti sewing squad like on like radical care, and the book I think might be really interesting because, you know, they do like talk about how like aunties, you know, the immigrant women, you know, do their like act of cooking and like the work of care, and then now like sewing masks during the pandemic is actually really embodying a new ways of knowledge production and politics. I was just reminded of that book when you were talking about your next project.
Yeah. And also I think this is focusing on eating and cooking is also a very feminist challenge to logocentric Western and also male-centered ideology that value for a long time rationality, mind, abstract things, but a very mundane bodily stuff at home is actually really crucial. I mean, we really need two different kinds of perspective to recenter what is essential in life, not only in individual lives, but also the national, but also ecological sense.
Yeah, and I love what you said about kind of like thinking about this like spatial politics, you know, also if from a point of view of like sensorial, like, yeah, like I love what you said about, yeah, recentering, yeah, like the mundane and bodily, and how also thinking about that as like a spatial challenge.
Yeah. And also have fun in doing research.
Yeah. This is really fun. I'm really excited for your next project. And I hope that I get to also interview you for that book when it comes out. Yeah.
Oh, that would be lovely. That would be great. So that's a good motivation for me to finish the book project soon.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much again for being here. It was such a pleasure being able to interview you and to have you here.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I think this was a so wonderful opportunity getting to know your research a little bit, and love to learn more about your exciting research project and also this new book network podcast program. This is an amazing program.
Yeah, it is a truly amazing program that like I think a lot of people like listen to. So I'm also excited for your books to reach more audience as well from this podcast. Yeah,
thank you so much.